This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The 57 Bus by Dashka Slater, narrated by Robin Miles. Author's note. This is a true story. All the people in this book are real, although in some cases pseudonyms or initials were used. Young people are identified by first name only. The details of the story were pieced together from a variety of sources, including interviews, documents, letters, videos, diaries, social media posts, and public records. Quotes from these sources are verbatim, except in a few cases where I removed last names, replacing them with long dashes. Information from first-hand accounts was corroborated with official records wherever possible, unless those records were sealed or are not available to the public. In those cases, I relied on the memory of witnesses and participants. The pronouns and names used for gender nonconforming people were approved by the people in question. Monday, November 4th, 2013. By 4:30 in the afternoon, the first mad rush of after-school passengers has come and gone. What's left are stragglers and staylaters, swiping their bus passes as they climb onto the 57 bus and take seats among the coming home workers, the shoppers and errand doers, the other students from high schools and middle schools around the city. The bus is loud, but not as loud as sometimes. A few clusters of kids are shouting and laughing, and an older woman at the front keeps talking to the driver. Dark is coming on. Daylight savings ended yesterday, and now evening rushes into the place where afternoon used to be. Everything is duskier, sleepier, wintrier now. Passengers look at their phones or stare through the scratched and grimy windows at the waning light. Sasha sits near the back. For much of the journey, the teenager has been reading a paperback copy of Anna Karenina for a class in Russian literature. Today, like most days, Sasha wears a t-shirt, a black fleece jacket, a gray flat cap, and a gauzy white skirt. A senior at a small private high school, the teenager identifies as agender, neither male nor female. As the bus lumbers through town, Sasha puts down the book and drifts into sleep, skirt draped over the edge of the seat. A few feet away, three teenage boys are laughing and joking. One of them, Richard, wears a black hoodie and an orange-billed New York Knicks hat. A 16-year-old junior at Oakland High School, he's got hazel eyes and a slow, sweet grin. He stands with his back to Sasha, gripping a pole for balance. Sasha sleeps as Richard and his companions goof around, play-fighting. Sleeps as Richard's cousin Lloyd bounds up and down the aisle, flirting with a girl up front. Sleeps as Richard surreptitiously flicks a lighter and touches it to the hem of that gauzy white skirt. Wait. In a moment, Sasha will wake inside a ball of flame and begin to scream. In a moment, everything will be set in motion. Taken by ambulance to a San Francisco burn unit, Sasha will spend the next 3.5 weeks undergoing multiple surgeries to treat second and third degree burns running from calf to thigh. Arrested at school the following day, Richard will be charged with 2 felonies, each with a hate crime clause that will add time to his sentence if he is convicted. Citing the severity of the crime, the district attorney will charge him as an adult, stripping him of the protections normally given to juveniles. Before the week is out, he will be facing the possibility of life imprisonment. But none of that has happened yet. For now, both teenagers are just taking the bus home from school. Surely it's not too late to stop things from going wrong. There must be some way to wake Sasha, divert Richard, get the driver to stop the bus. There must be something you can do. Oakland, California. Oakland, California is a city of more than 400,000 people, but it can still feel like a small town. not small geographically, of course. The city sprawls across 78 square miles, stretching from the shallow, salty estuary at the edge of San Francisco Bay to the undulating green and gold hills where bobcats and coyotes roam. What makes it feel small is the web of connections, the way people's stories tangle together. Our lives make footprints, tracks in the snows of time. People know each other's parents or siblings, their aunties and cousins. They go to school together or worship together. They play sports on the same team or work in the same building. The tracks cross, the stories overlap. Oakland is considered one of the most diverse cities in the country. It's Asian and Latino, black and white, African, Arab, Indian, Iranian, Native American, and Pacific Islander. No one group is a majority. It has more lesbian couples per capita than any city in the nation, and one of the largest proportions of gay and lesbian-headed households. It's a city that prides itself on its open-mindedness, its lack of pretension, and its homegrown slang. Oaklanders say hella when they mean very, and hecka when they want to be polite about it. But for all its laid-back inclusiveness, Oakland is also a city of stark contrasts. In 2013, the year Sasha was burned, Oakland ranked 7th among American cities in income inequality, just below New York. Its per capita rate of violent crime made it the second most dangerous city in America, but its citizens still paid some of the highest rents in the country. Gravity works backward here. The money flows uphill. The wealthier neighborhoods in the hills boast good schools, low crime, and views of the bay. Thanks to the Bay Area's high-tech boom, long vacant historic buildings downtown are filling with startups, boutiques peddling handmade jeans, and night spots serving 7-ingredient cocktails. But little of this good fortune spilled over into the flatlands of East Oakland, where Richard lived. This is where the bulk of the city's murders happen, 2/3 of them in 2013. The schools are shabbier here. The test scores are lower. There's more trash on the streets, more roaming dogs, more liquor stores, fewer grocery stores. The median strips are ragged with weeds. The 57 bus travels through both kinds of neighborhoods, traversing an 11-mile path from one end of the city to the other. It begins at the northwest corner of Oakland and lumbers diagonally through the city, crossing the middle-class foothills where Sasha lived and where Richard went to school, and then chugging along MacArthur Boulevard for 120 blocks. The route terminates at the city's southeast border, close to Richard's house. Each afternoon, the two teenagers' journeys overlapped for a mere 8 minutes. If it hadn't been for the 57 bus, their paths might never have crossed at all. Part 1. Sasha. Tumbling. Adapted from Sasha's Tumblr page. Favorite vegetable, bok choy. Favorite animals, cat and cuttlefish. Favorite type of movie, dream sequences. 3 best qualities, navigation. My friends seem to like me. Purple. Of course I like hats. Anyone who doesn't is wrong. I like compliments. I dislike compliments. I like my hair. I give good hugs. I'm good at finding potential puns. If the whole world was listening, I might just rant about a bunch of things like gender, wealth inequality, why school is important. I like parties. I dislike parties. I don't really keep track of disappointments. Ideal vacation spot? Probably a city with a nice subway. Thinking of things to get me? Try this. A brass airship, a transit map shower curtain, a medieval cloak, a corset with silver buttons, a chiseled chunk of gallium that melts in your palm, a dress swirled with the image of a nebula, a Victorian house on wheels, tights painted like a mermaid tail. Pronouns. Even as a toddler, Sasha was interested in language. Not in learning Italian or Swahili or Mandarin, but in language itself, its shape and structure, the Lego blocks of sounds that snap together to make words and sentences. Most toddlers are interested in the fact that the animal with two pointy ears and a long tail is called a cat. Sasha was interested in the fact that adding an S at the end of the word cat made it plural. Look, Sasha would say, two cat-s. Before turning three, Sasha was matching sounds with letters, sometimes in unusual ways. B is for baby, Sasha would exclaim. Y is for wire. 10 is for tent. At four, Sasha was reading independently, but had also begun contemplating the shapes of letters. K is one rectangle and two parallelograms, Sasha announced at the breakfast table one day. M is two parallelograms and two rectangles. 2 years later, Sasha began creating a new language. It was called Astrolinguish, and it was the language of Sasha's home planet, Astrolingua. Written Astrolinguish was awash in diacritical marks, with lots of umlauts, accents, and tildes. The spoken language luxuriated in rolled R's and L's. As a senior in high school, Sasha was still inventing languages, hanging out online with other conlangers, people who construct languages of their own. By now, Sasha was working up a new language. This one never had a name, but it was spoken by the members of an imaginary agricultural society, something like that of ancient Mesopotamia. All languages embody the obsessions of the people who speak them, and so Sasha's language was meant to reflect the interests of a people whose world was dominated by growing seasons, grains, and harvests. Instead of pronouns that distinguished between male and female, Sasha's language had pronouns that distinguished between animate and inanimate objects. The word for sun was jej, which was also the word for day. The difference was that sun was considered animate, a being, and day was considered inanimate, a thing. Our language, English, works differently. We care a lot about gender, and English reflects that in its pronouns, she or he, her or him, hers or his. You might think this is just how languages work in the real world, but there are many languages on Earth that are basically gender neutral, using the same word for he, she, and it, or not using pronouns at all. You've probably heard of some of them. They include Armenian, Comanche, Finnish, Hungarian, Hindi, Indonesian, Quechua, Thai, Tagalog, Turkish, Vietnamese, and Yoruba. English, on the other hand, poses a challenge for people like Sasha, who don't see themselves as fitting into neat either-or categories like male or female. Sasha, like many gender non-conforming people, wants to be referred to with the pronoun they. It might feel awkward at first, but you'll get used to it. 1001 blank white cards. For their 16th birthday, Sasha asked for an accordion, a manual typewriter, a Soviet flag, and a new Rubik's Cube. They didn't know how to play the accordion, but they might have learned if they had received one, which they didn't. They didn't get the flag either, although Sasha and their friend Michael made a cardboard hammer and sickle not long afterward and hung it on Sasha's bedroom wall. At the time, they were obsessed with everything having to do with Russia and communism. Their friend Carrie, who took the bus with Sasha that year, remembers Sasha going on and on about it during the bus ride home from school. Sasha, once you get to know them, is very outspoken about things, she explains. That's once you get to know them. When you first meet Sasha, they're quiet and shy. They have chin-length, wavy brown hair, a pale round face, and thick dark eyebrows. When they smile, their eyes crinkle into slits. They wear glasses, round, owlish ones, and they don't always look at you straight on. As a child, they were diagnosed with Asperger's, a form of autism, which can make them awkward socially. But it also makes them passionate about their interests, and the passion eventually trumps the shyness. What was Sasha passionate about when they were a senior in high school? Buses, cartoons, and the color purple, says Healy, one of Sasha's closest friends. To that, you could add communism, games, the webcomic Homestuck, and live-action role-playing, or LARPing. Also, the ska-pop punk band Sarcasm, which was formed by some kids at Maybeck High School and had once proclaimed Sasha their biggest fan. And veganism, although Sasha disliked the way other vegans on the internet made such a huge deal about it. Sasha's best friend was Michael, a tall, gangly kid with sandy blonde hair and thick glasses who always wore a gray beanie and a green army jacket. Michael and Sasha had been pretty much inseparable since freshman year, when they met while playing the board game Diplomacy. Over time, they formed the nucleus of a tight circle of friends. Sasha, Healy, Michael, Michael's girlfriend Taya, and another friend named Ian. Ian, blonde, bearded, with a habit of tucking his chin and looking up at you from under his eyebrows, was the one who never stopped talking. Red-haired Healy was the unquellable fountain of excitement who stole people's hats and wore her emotions on her sleeve. Cherub-faced Taya loved costumes and dancing. She and Michael were so close that their friends referred to them as a single person named Tykel. When the two got too cuddly, Sasha would get between them and shout, "Leave room for Jesus!" at the top of their lungs, like the chaperone at a Christian prom. Sasha was the brilliant one, the one who blazed through calculus, linguistics, physics, and computer programming with a kind of effortlessness. Not that any of them were slouches when it came to academics. Kids who weren't into school were unlikely to choose Maybeck, a private high school with roughly 100 kids that rented space on 2 floors of a Presbyterian church in Berkeley. In the tiny classrooms, students gathered around conference tables and critiqued the concept of America as a shining city on a hill, or compared the writings of Charles Darwin and Ursula K. Le Guin. Teachers liked to claim that Maybeck didn't have cliques like other high schools, and it was true that the place was a refuge for kids like Healy, who had been bullied in middle school. People were nice to each other at Maybeck, accepting. But the school still had social groupings, just like any other high school. Arty kids, stoners, bros. "We were the nerdy kids," Ian says. "The funny, sort of crazy nerdy people who played video games and watched anime and read manga." All of them were fascinated by games. Board games, video games, card games, role-playing games, trading card games. At lunch and after school, they often gathered at a wooden table in the hallway that people called the Hex table, even though, as Ian pointed out, it was an octagon, not a hexagon. There they played cards, particularly a game Michael and Sasha had learned from a couple of seniors when they were freshmen. It was officially called 1001 Blank White Cards, although they mostly just called it Index Cards. "It's a game played with index cards," Sasha explains, "not all of which are white, and at this point, very few of which are blank." The deck grew over time, with people pilfering index cards from classrooms whenever they wanted to expand it. If you drew a blank card from the deck, that meant you could fill it in, assigning it a point value and an effect. The more random, the better. Over time, the deck filled up with in-jokes. There was a card featuring a drawing of The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway that resulted in the player losing 2 turns as you read the book and are bored to death. There was a card that required you to talk in a Russian accent, a card that required you to lisp, and a card that required you to lisp while talking in a Russian accent. There were cards that required you to play an air guitar solo, speak like an English-dubbed anime character, eat leaves like a giraffe, engage in staring contests, and end every sentence with the word Daug. There was a card called Tower of Hats that required you to take everyone else's hats and wear them in a stack. There was a card that said, Game Over, Ian Wins, that had been created as a birthday present for Ian. Sasha created a card called A Complete History of the Soviet Union as Told by a Humble Worker, Arranged to the Melody of Tetris, which was the name of a 6.5-minute song by an obscure British comedy band called Pig with the Face of a Boy. Michael and Sasha were both obsessed with the song and sang it at every opportunity. The effect of the card is that you have to sing the song or lose a turn, Sasha explains. Aside from Ian's birthday card, there was no way to win the game and no real goal. They just played until people had to go home. By graduation, the stack of index cards was about 2 feet high and had to be carried in a special bag. But at the beginning, most of those 1,001 white cards were blank. Back then, Sasha was called Luke, and they were referred to as he. Luke and Samantha. In middle school, Sasha was brainy, shy, and introverted, the kind of kid who is easy to overlook. Sasha's father, Carl, refers to that quality as Sasha's invisibility cloak. They blend into the background, he explains. They've always been that sort of kid, that nobody even knows they're there. Sasha didn't seem to need other people much. In fact, they often said that the world would be better off without humans in it at all. The world inside their head was fascinating enough. They thought about numbers a lot, and shapes, and the size of the universe. They drew imaginary subway maps and worked out math problems on a whiteboard the family kept in the breakfast nook. They were interested in space and Legos and trains and the ancient Greeks, and they noticed things most people didn't, like the subtle shades within the green of a leaf, or the geometric shapes within a sculpture. They loved cats and had a habit of meowing. Sasha couldn't say whether any of this was because they had Asperger's, because, of course, they'd never not had Asperger's. The only mind they'd ever been inside was their own. In sixth grade, Sasha started attending a tiny K-8 Montessori school with about 25 kids in each grade. They were in a mixed-age class of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, and there was just one other new kid that year, an apple-cheeked fifth grader named Samantha. She looked right past Sasha's invisibility cloak and saw a kindred spirit. Samantha was a head taller than Sasha, with tousled blonde hair, ivory skin that flushed easily, and wire-rimmed glasses. Her family moved around a lot, and at 10 she'd already lived in 5 states and attended 6 different elementary schools. But she had never had a best friend. She was used to being an outcast, to feeling both smarter than other kids and stupider. Her dad was a nanotechnologist whose laboratory was in their basement. He'd been giving her what he called dad homework for her whole life, and she'd always gotten pleasure from demonstrating her intelligence. Yet she could never seem to learn the rules that other kids played by, the rules that defined how you were supposed to talk and how you were supposed to look and what you were supposed to be interested in, rules that defined how smart was too smart. Samantha noticed that Sasha wrote their name on homework assignments in Greek letters. She noticed that Sasha loved math and costumes and imaginary worlds. She noticed how passionate Sasha was about everything, their conviction that the ancient Greeks were better than the ancient Romans, that base 12 counting was better than base 10, that cats were better than dogs. She noticed Sasha's long eyelashes and their curly shoulder-length brown hair. "Samantha has a crush on me," Sasha told Carl with a kind of anthropological interest. And it was true, she did. It didn't take long for the two of them to become inseparable. Sasha adopted Samantha's way of talking, pronouncing fail when something was lame and LOL when something was funny. They played Dungeons and Dragons and then left the 12-sided die on the floor and invented magical battles of their own. They each adopted a tiny invisible baby dragon. Sasha's was named Cinnamon, Samantha's was Pendragon. They invented stupid TV shows, unleashing a cavalcade of ever-increasing banality as they tried to out-stupid each other. They were so close that Samantha felt like Sasha was inside her head, thinking her thoughts before she'd even thought them herself. That closeness, of course, drew the attention of their classmates. As far as anyone could tell, Samantha was a girl and Sasha was a boy. The teasing was merciless. Everyone wanted to know if they were boyfriend and girlfriend, if they were K-I-S-S-I-N-G. They weren't. It drove Samantha crazy. She once grabbed a classmate by the arm, yelling, "Stop making fun of us!" Her fingers hit a pressure point, and the girl screamed in pain. Samantha felt terrible about it, but still, why couldn't everyone just leave them alone? It was part of that disorienting feeling she'd had for years, that feeling that everyone except her had been issued a handbook. Samantha knew it was important to be pretty and cute, but she had no idea how to be those things, or even why she was supposed to want to be. Her body was growing curvier. Breasts burst from her chest like twin cannonballs, but they didn't feel sexy and good. They just felt heavy. She hid them under baggy t-shirts and sweatshirts and watched the other girls come to school in tiny skirts and spaghetti straps, wondering why everything was so much harder for her than it was for them. "Tell me how to be popular," she begged one of the spaghetti strap girls. The girl's expression, her lowered eyes, the way she glanced around seeking escape, told Samantha what a mistake the question had been. If you have to ask, it's out of reach. Something was wrong with her, really wrong. She was angry, she was sad, she was afraid, she wanted to die. In sixth grade, she said so in class. Her teacher told her parents, who took her to a therapist. One day, Samantha told the therapist about a video she'd seen on YouTube. Two young women stood back to back, performing a slam poem called Her, rotating to face the mic as they gave voice to a girl named Melissa and the boy inside her named James. Sometimes she wishes she could rip the skin off her back. Every moment of every day she feels trapped in the flesh of a stranger. Watching it, Samantha felt something chime inside her, a bell vibrating in resonance. Before puberty, her physical body didn't seem to have that much to do with who she was. People used to mistake her for a boy, but she'd felt proud to be a girl. But now, being a girl was like being stuffed into a heavy, constricting costume. She could barely breathe in it. The rules of the universe were fixed. You look a certain way, and so you have to act a certain way, and people are going to treat you a certain way. There was no way to alter it. "I think I might be transgender," she whispered to her therapist the next week. "I don't think you know what transgender means," her therapist replied. The bell that had been chiming inside her fell silent. She's the expert, Samantha thought. It would be another year before she told anyone else. Gran Turismo 2. Sasha and Samantha were playing Gran Turismo 2 in Sasha's basement. Samantha was in seventh grade, Sasha was in eighth. Samantha took a breath. "I have something really important to tell you." Sasha's eyes were on the screen where their two cars were racing. "What?" "I'm transgender." She told Sasha about the way she'd been feeling and about the response she'd gotten from her therapist the year before. "You're the only one who knows what you feel," Sasha said. "If that's the word for what you feel, then stick with that. Now, what's the important thing you had to tell me?" 5 years later, a handsome, apple-cheeked young man named Andrew would look back at that conversation as one of the most validating moments of his life. It wasn't that I was expecting Sasha to react poorly, because I know Sasha, and Sasha is easily one of the smartest people I've ever met, and also one of the kindest, he recalled. But taking a risk like that and having everything be okay afterward felt so good. Back in seventh grade, Andrew rarely spoke about gender with Sasha after that one conversation. He wouldn't tell his parents he was trans for another year. For a while, he convinced himself that being a girl would be okay, that being trans was just too hard a life. When Sasha was in ninth grade, Andrew was their date to the Maybeck prom. He wore a bottle green dress and blood red lipstick, and his hair was dyed coppery orange. But it was still just a costume. The dress, the lipstick, the hair, the body. By the time he started high school in the fall, Andrew had already begun his gender transition. How do you know what gender you are? Sasha and Andrew were hanging out in Sasha's bedroom. It was the winter of 2012. Sasha was a sophomore at Maybeck High School, and Andrew was a freshman at a public high school nearby. Sasha was at the computer, showing Andrew the ins and outs of the board game Diplomacy. Andrew, Sasha said, I don't know if this is rude or not, but I was wondering how you realized you were a guy. I just knew I wasn't a girl, Andrew explained. I just knew that was not who I was at all. Andrew had recently been hospitalized after contemplating suicide. Even though he'd started high school as a boy, his trans status was a topic of constant rumor and gossip. People at school kept coming up and saying awkward and nonsensical things like, I heard you got a sex transplant. And then his mother had a psychotic episode and his grandfather died, and it was just too much all at once. Now, as Sasha explained that they also were questioning their gender, Andrew felt a rush of relief, similar to the one he'd felt when he came out to Sasha. The fact that someone like Sasha, who I respected so much, was also going through this, it was another thank God moment, Andrew remembered later. Like, I'm not such a weird person. Not everyone had that reaction, though. For most people, the question was kind of mysterious. I just know, Sasha's father Carl said, when Sasha asked how he knew he was a man. It's who I am. That seemed to be true for most people. They just knew. Whether or not the appearance of their body matched the gender in their mind, there was some core understanding. My identity is this. But Sasha didn't feel that. Didn't feel strongly, this is what I am. Didn't feel strongly, this is what I'm not. Other people seemed to have a file in their brain marked gender. Sasha ransacked their own brain looking for the file, but it didn't seem to be there. So what did that mean? The idea of not having a gender wasn't frightening to Sasha, but it wasn't a relief either. Maybe this is just a phase, Sasha thought. Maybe I'm just overthinking things. But maybe not. Maybe the question was its own kind of answer. Maybe the place in between was a real place. For me, at least, gender queer includes an aspect of questioning, Sasha explains. The fact that I was questioning my gender meant that I was gender queer. Still, Sasha kept probing. On Facebook, they posted a status update asking, What is your preferred pronoun? Your Highness, Carl quipped. But afterward, he asked Sasha what the question meant. Sasha explained that there were other choices besides he and she, choices like it or they, or more recently invented gender-neutral pronouns like ni, vi, and z, spelled z-e or x-e. Listening, it became clear to Carl that this was a topic Sasha had been thinking about a lot. Not long afterward, Sasha was talking with their parents about someone they'd met online who identified as gender queer. "Are you genderqueer?" asked Debbie, Sasha's mother.
"Yeah,"
Sasha said. That was the extent of the conversation. But that night, Sasha posted on Google Plus, "Just came out as genderqueer to my parents. Basically, I don't identify as masculine or feminine." Reading the post and the congratulatory comments that followed it, Debbie and Carl were left scratching their heads. Apparently, something big had just happened, but they weren't entirely sure what it was. What did genderqueer even mean?
Genderqueer.
Debbie and Carl had always had a good relationship with Sasha. As a family, they joked around a lot, but they also talked seriously about the stuff that mattered. And clearly, this gender stuff mattered to Sasha. Only it was kind of hard to figure out why. Was this about sex? About love? About changing your body? "I'm trying to get my head around it," Debbie said, 2 years after that first conversation. "I understand coming out as gay or even trans, but this is harder for me to understand." She and Carl were sitting side by side on the claret-colored sofa in their living room, framed by the bay window behind them. They live in a snug green bungalow in Oakland's Glenview district, about a mile from Oakland High School. Debbie, who works as a bookkeeper at a private elementary school, has a mobile, expressive face framed by blonde, chin-length hair. Her gestures are broad and comic. Carl is shyer and more quiet, a former college radio DJ turned public school kindergarten teacher. He has a gentle, thoughtful manner, punctuated by a dry wit. He wears his silvering hair short on the sides and has a rainbow friendship bracelet tied around one wrist. Debbie's mind kept going to the sex part. Who did Sasha want to sleep with? After Sasha announced they were gender queer, she asked for clarification. "Who are you attracted to? Do you have sexual feelings for men?" But that wasn't the issue for Sasha. They weren't all that interested in having sex with anyone, actually. And anyway, terms like homosexual or heterosexual made no sense if you didn't identify as one gender or another. Most of us see gender and sexuality and romance as one big, interconnected tangle of feelings. This is who I am, this is who I'm attracted to, this is who I love. But as Sasha began exploring the topic online, they found that some people had developed language for combing the tangle into individual strands. In these online conversations, the word sex referred purely to biology, the chromosomes, organs, and anatomy that define male and female from the outside. Gender was the word for what people felt about themselves, how they felt inside. Sexuality was the category for who you were physically attracted to. Romantic was the category for who you felt romantic attraction to. And there was a whole array of distinctions within each category as well. It was like a gigantic menu with columns and columns of choices. Gender, sex, sexuality, romance. Some terms. Because language is evolving rapidly, and because different people have different preferences, always adopt the language individuals use about themselves, even if it differs from what's here. Terms for gender and sex. Agender, new choice, doesn't identify as any gender. Androgynous, identifies as a third gender that blends male and female characteristics. Bigender, gender fluid, sometimes identifies as male and sometimes as female. Cis, cisgender, the opposite of transgender. Gender matches their birth sex. Gender questioning, is unsure about where they belong on the gender spectrum. Gender queer, non-binary. Gender identity doesn't fit neatly into male-female categories. Intersex, born with sexual anatomy, organs, or chromosomes that don't seem to fit the typical definitions of female or male. replaces the outdated and offensive term, hermaphrodite. Trans, transgender, feels their gender is different from their birth sex, whether or not they have physically changed their body or outward presentation. A transgender man is someone who currently identifies as male. A transgender woman is someone who currently identifies as female. Terms for sexuality. Asexual, not physically attracted to anyone. Bisexual, physically attracted to both men and women. Cupiosexual, doesn't feel sexual attraction, but is still interested in sex. Graysexual, mostly doesn't feel sexual attraction, but does occasionally. Heterosexual, physically attracted to people of the opposite gender. Homosexual, physically attracted to people of the same gender. Pansexual, physically attracted to people across the gender spectrum. Terms for romantic inclination. Aromantic, not romantically attracted to anyone. Biromantic, romantically attracted to both men and women. Cupioromantic, doesn't feel romantic attraction, but is still interested in romance. Heteroromantic, romantically attracted to people of the opposite gender. Homoromantic, romantically attracted to people of the same gender. Panromantic, romantically attracted to people across the gender spectrum. Quaromantic, doesn't understand the difference between romantic and platonic love. Sasha's terms. In the end, these were the terms Sasha felt described them best. Agender, gray cupiosexual, qua romantic, also vegan. Becoming Sasha. Discovering the existence of genderqueer identity felt like discovering a secret room. All this time, there had been just two rooms, male and female. Now it turned out there was another room, one that could be furnished however you wanted. The more time Sasha spent in this room, the more comfortable it felt. But the person who lived in this new room still had a boy's name, Luke. By the second half of sophomore year, that name clearly no longer fit. One afternoon, when Andrew was hanging out at Sasha's house, the two of them began looking at unisex names on Wikipedia. Jamie, Shannon, Taylor, Fran, Jackie, Chris, Bobby, Kai, Parker, Quinn, Sasha. Sasha was the Russian nickname for both Alexandra and Alexander, which was Sasha's middle name. And Sasha was crazy about all things Russian. The name was perfect. Gradually, Sasha asked their parents and close friends to call them Sasha instead of Luke. That spring, Sasha wrote a piece for the Maybeck school zine, The Pineapple, about their exploration of gender. They used their new name as the byline. Most people at school had no idea who this Sasha person was, but as students and staff made the connection between Sasha and the person formerly known as Luke, they absorbed the information without much comment. It wasn't really drama, Michael recalls. It was just a change. Ian has two moms, so he was pretty comfortable with LGBTQ stuff. He remembers his thought process going like this. Okay, not male. Okay, not female. So, neither? Okay. That was the process, and it took about 10 seconds, he says. Then it was over. I just rolled with the fact that Sasha was agender, Taya says. I think it was my first experience with it, but I was raised by hippies. At another school, a student who stepped outside the usual gender categories might have been the topic of gossip or debate, or at least a few raised eyebrows. But Maybeck's small student body already included one student who was agender and two who were transgender. Multiple people would come out and you'd be like, okay, they're this, and they use this name and this pronoun now, says Sasha's friend, Carrie. I mean, like, not everyone was good at it, but the people who were friends with trans people were. The friends who made the effort to get it right gave Sasha the confidence to correct the acquaintances who got it wrong. And more, the pronoun he felt wrong. I don't want for people to think of me as a he. And when they say he, not only does it reinforce in their brains that I am a he, it also reinforces it in the brains of the people who are listening. Sasha explains, it doesn't really directly affect me, at least to hear it. It's more like, huh, that's not right. And when people use the right pronouns, when they use they or another gender-neutral pronoun, it feels validating. A card called Luke, Sasha, person, was added to the index card deck. If someone calls Sasha by the wrong name, the card instructed, the offender must discard a card from his, her hand. Bathrooms. Sometimes, Debbie felt as she stood at the gas station, the whole non-binary thing was a pain in the ass. It was Thanksgiving, 2012, Sasha's junior year of high school. Debbie, Carl, and Sasha were driving to Southern California to spend the holiday with Debbie's sister. A couple of hours in, Sasha had requested a bathroom stop, which was why they were now parked at a gas station off Interstate 5. But Sasha had surveyed the two options, men and women, and walked back to the car. "There's no bathroom for me," they said, climbing into the back seat. Debbie was furious. Was this really how Sasha was going to go through life, with their bladder full to bursting? "It's not healthy," she fumed. "There's not always going to be a bathroom available for you. You have to be more flexible." But Sasha refused to budge. They held it in for the rest of the six-hour drive. It was tough sometimes, watching Sasha navigate a world that didn't even have a category for them. Occasionally, Debbie wished Sasha would ease up a little, resist correcting well-meaning relatives who said he instead of they, for example. But there was something admirable about it, too, Carl pointed out. Knowing how shy Sasha was, he admired Sasha's newfound willingness to speak up, to stand out, to be seen. I wonder if Sasha hadn't been in a school where alternatives to the norm were part of the culture and accepted, if they would have been struggling more to figure out where they fit in the scheme of things, he said. It feels like making this discovery has really helped Sasha become themselves. Bathrooms Revisited. Over the course of the next year, Sasha found a way to deal with the problem of bathrooms. At Maybeck, they used the staff bathroom. Out in the world, they used whatever bathroom had the shortest line, whatever bathroom was closer, or whatever bathroom was least conspicuous. If they had to use the bathroom multiple times in one place, they alternated. Nobody seemed to care which bathroom they used, or if they did. Sasha didn't notice. Skirts. Sasha wore a skirt for the first time during sophomore year, on Maybeck's annual cross-dressing day. This was before they started thinking about gender, when dressing up as a girl was just a gag that the whole school was taking part in. Everyone, regardless of orientation, clothed in exaggerated masculine or feminine costumes. Sasha borrowed a skirt from their friend Carrie, who lived in Sasha's neighborhood. What struck them then was how comfortable it was to wear one. In January 2013, when Sasha was a junior, they turned to Carrie again. "I don't have any feminine clothes," they complained. Sasha had been identifying as agender for almost a year by now, but they still dressed the same as they always had, like a boy. "I have lots of feminine clothes," Carrie replied. "Too many." She brought a garbage bag full of hand-me-downs to school, mostly skirts she'd worn in middle school. Sasha sifted through them, and after trying on a few skirts in the bathroom, chose three to take home. Aside from during one school trip to China, they never wore pants again. Previously, Sasha's style had tended toward steampunk. Top hat and tweeds, vests, bow ties, even a pocket watch and a pair of fighter pilot goggles. Sasha liked the sartorial gender mashup that came from adding a skirt to this ensemble. Masculine above, feminine below. But there were plenty of days when they didn't bother getting fancy, pairing one of Carrie's old skirts with a t-shirt and knee socks. The outfits weren't flamboyant, but they made Debbie nervous. She knew Sasha would be fine at school. If anything, the skirts gave them a little extra cachet at Maybeck, where unconventionality was an asset. It was the bus that worried her. Wearing skirts meant that Sasha was shedding that cloak of invisibility. Now they weren't just visible, but conspicuous. And outside of the cocoon of Maybeck High School, being conspicuous wasn't always a good idea. Transgender people are the victims of an astonishing amount of violence. One out of every four trans people has experienced a bias-driven assault, and the numbers are higher for trans women, trans people of color, and people who identify as neither male nor female. Of the 860 non-binary people who responded to the 2008 National Transgender Discrimination Survey, 32% had been physically assaulted. "Did anyone give you a hard time?" Debbie would ask when Sasha got home from school. The answer was always no. "No, it's fine. I'll be all right." One day at a bus stop, an older woman approached Sasha. "Why are you wearing a skirt?" she demanded. "You're not a girl." "I'm wearing a skirt because I like wearing skirts," Sasha replied. That was the worst of it. A single, unfriendly question from a woman old enough to be Sasha's grandmother. Even so, Debbie worried. Running. Carl was out for a run on Hillegas Avenue, a residential street close to the border between Oakland and Berkeley. It was late November, 1987. He was in his early 20s, unmarried, and working at a nearby cafe. Fugitive scents wisped past his nose as he ran. Oak leaves, fog, jasmine, car exhaust, ocean breeze, his own sweat. He was lost in the staccato thud of his shoes hitting the pavement, the huff of his breath, the metronome of his heart. "Hey, I like your legs." A truck slowed down to roll behind him. Heartbeat louder now, his chest a megaphone. A side-eye peep. Three young guys in a pickup. One leaned out the window. "Let me suck your prick." Adrenaline gushed into Carl's veins. He veered down busy Alcatraz Avenue, legs churning. The truck followed. He doubled back to Hillegas, heartbeat pounding out the words of his puzzlement. "What do they want from me?" His pursuers threw the truck into reverse and revved past him, slowing down to let one of the men get out. Carl sprinted down a side street. The truck zoomed forward again, following. Carl's t-shirt was damp with a melange of different kinds of sweat. Heat, effort, fear. Adrenaline kited him down the street. Then the truck pulled over just in front of him. The driver got out, blocking the sidewalk. "Hey, why don't you talk to us?" Carl halted in mid-stride. Alarm swamped his ears. "Because I'm busy," he choked out. He didn't even hear the second guy come up behind him. When he came to, he was lying on the sidewalk in a circle of concerned bystanders, his head and face aching. The police were on their way. The guys who had attacked him were long gone. That evening, he wrote about the incident in his journal. "Pretty bizarre," he commented. He didn't bother ruminating on why he'd been singled out, why the men had assumed he was gay. It was just a random event, a one-time thing, not likely to be repeated. The petition. All school meetings at Maybeck are held every Wednesday in the sanctuary of the Presbyterian Church downstairs. Students sprawl in the pews to hear musical performances, make announcements, and sometimes hear a guest speaker. One day, in March of junior year, Sasha mounted the semi-circular stage and announced three things. One, I'm Sasha, and I identify as agender. Two, it's important to respect people's preferred pronouns, and if you're not sure what those are, you should ask. Three, I'm petitioning the White House to recognize non-binary gender. Anyone can start a petition on the We the People website at whitehouse.gov requesting that the federal government address a problem or change a policy. If a petition gets enough signatures within a 30-day window, the White House will issue an official response. Sasha's petition read as follows. Legal documents in the United States only recognize male and female as genders, leaving anyone who does not identify as one of these two genders with no option. Australia and New Zealand both allow an X in place of an M or an F on passports for this purpose, and the UK recognizes MX, pronounced mix, as a gender-neutral title. This petition asks the Obama administration to legally recognize genders outside of the male-female binary and provide an option for these genders on all legal documents and records. To Sasha's astonishment, the petition garnered more than 27,000 signatures. That would have been enough to trigger an official response from the White House were it not for a petition circulated a couple of months earlier asking the White House to build a Death Star like the one in the movie Star Wars. After the Death Star petition got more than 34,000 signatures, the White House raised the number of signatures required for an official response from 25,000 to 100,000. Still, 27,000 signatures wasn't too shabby. That was 27,000 people reading and agreeing with my words, words that I had written, Sasha said. That felt pretty great. Clipboards. At the end of the school year, Sasha went to Sequoia Elementary School, where Carl worked, to help pack up his kindergarten classroom for the summer. As they boxed up books and folders and unpinned words from the word wall, Sasha noticed the pair of clipboards parents used to sign out their kids at the end of the day. One clipboard was marked girls, the other was marked boys. What about the kids who aren't either one? Sasha asked. Which clipboard do they go on? It's just a logistical thing, Carl explained. I want to have clipboards on both sides of the door so there isn't a big line. It's just easier this way. He couldn't imagine that kindergartners would care about gender one way or the other. In August, when Carl returned to his classroom to set up for the new school year, he unpacked the clipboards from the box where Sasha had stowed them. As he hung them up on their hooks by the door, Sasha's comment came back to him. Would it really be that hard to divide things up some other way? Using a black Sharpie, he wrote new labels for the clipboards, A through M and N through Z. It was a little thing, easy enough to change, he decided. 3 years later, Carl's classroom included a boy who sometimes liked to dress as a princess and a girl who talked about maybe being a boy someday. Turned out, Sasha was right, Carl said. Kindergartners don't want to be pigeonholed. Best day ever. Best day ever. It was a trademark Sasha phrase, as in, that was the best day ever. If you have a lot of obsessions, a lot of things you really like, the opportunity for best days ever increases. On a college visit to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge the summer before senior year, Sasha met a fellow fan of the intricately plotted webcomic Homestuck on a subway platform. The person complimented Sasha's skirt and said, I would be wearing mine, but it's in the wash. The two exchanged Tumblr URLs. Best.